4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we explore what it means to be living in the new geologic age. I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today we'll be featuring an interview with Professor Rodolfo Durzo. Stay with us.
My name is Brian Barney. I am a first-year PhD student in the Ecology and Evolution Department here at Stanford, and I will be interviewing Rodolfo Durzo.
And why did you choose Rodolfo?
Well, he and I did a field ecology course in September of 2011 together, where a number of first-year graduate students went down to Veracruz, Mexico, and that's actually where Las Tuxtlas Biosphere Preserve is. Yeah, it was a really, really great experience, and I came to respect him rather quickly. You don't get much closer than you do when you're in the middle of a rainforest with somebody for a couple of weeks.
Very cool. Well, I'm looking forward to your interview. I think it's going to be great.
Me as well. Okay. Hello, everyone. Thanks for listening. My name is Brian Barney, and I'm here with Professor Rodolfo Durzo. He's the Bing Professor in Ecology at Stanford University. A couple of awards that he's received relatively recently. In 1992, he was the Pew Scholar in Conservation from the Pew Charitable Trust. And in 2004, he was elected as a foreign member in the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and as a foreign associate in the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. So well-heralded and well-deserved. Thank you, Dr. Durzo, for coming and talking with us today.
It is my pleasure. Pleasure, Brian. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
So the topic that we're going to talk about for this interview is the idea of the Anthropocene. And I know that you have a particular unique connection to the origin of this idea of the Anthropocene. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yes. You know, I was so fortunate to have had a good interaction with Paul Crutz, who happens to be the person who first produced a little paper to discuss within the IGBP. The IGBP is International Geosphere and Biosphere Program. It's one of those international programs that have to deal and address the issues of global environmental change in general. Mm-hmm. Like that, there is also one which is very close to our heart, certainly very close to my heart, which is the Diversitas Program, which is another program of that nature, also that family, which looks at biological diversity in particular, and so on. But at any rate, the IGBP had a scientific committee, and Paul and I happened to be at the time in the scientific committee. So, you know, the idea that that he was discussing with us was these changes on the planet, and he was thinking about using something that would be that would make the situation visible and attractive, and he came up with this idea of thinking about the Anthropocene. So he came up with a discussion, and we had a little bit of discussion within the IGBP. But then he published a very short paper in the journal Nature, which is obviously a very visible journal. But of course that brought a lot of visibility to the term. And you know, for the people who are listening to us, it might be easy to guess what this is about because of the word itself, Anthropos, meaning related to humans, and so the other part of the word, the Anthropocene, relates to the idea that, you know, the planet has gone through a number of geological eras or epochs or periods, and this was the idea to bring to the people the notion that the planet is undergoing a very different situation given the human footprint, given the human impact, and that therefore a new term was actually in order. Let me mention another thing that is really very close to the heart of Stanford, which is another professor in the biology department, Peter Vitusek. Together with some other people, they came up with this incredible analysis. Just listen to this. Primary productivity, which is the capture of the energy of the sun and then the use of water and carbon to create oxygen, and then plant biomass is the fundamental reason why this planet works, right? Plant biomass is the food for the base of the food chain. These guys have estimated that 40% of the total primary productivity of the planet Earth is co-opted, captured, kidnapped by one species, Homo sapiens.
In kind of thinking about, you know, the Anthropocene and this human footprint that we talk about,
yes.
Where do you think that you would put that boundary? What in the course of human history, what is the kind of, let's say, the defining moment or the defining era in human history that you think is right. Where that change starts?
Right. You know, Brian, it might be a question that is a little bit tricky to define and mm-hmm. to find an exact moment. In fact, if you and people in general, when they look at sort of the geological clock or the geological calendar, when they look for the moment in which one epoch or period is defined and sort of the boundary and separation from the other, usually we talk about, you know, a number of millions of years.
Right.
so sometimes the sort of the division is not so sharp. But, you know, trying to make an effort in coming up with an idea as to what would be a sort of a decisive element that brought about or made the Anthropocene evident, I would probably say the Industrial Revolution. So it might not have been exactly that very second, but I think that was a crucial moment in the definition of the Anthropocene. And, you know, since then, many changes have been evident, and many changes have been associated to that moment. And of course, the rate of change has been very dramatic in the last few decades. So some people would say, for example, that it's just the most recent decades. If you think that the most important factor of the Anthropocene is, for example, land use change or deforestation, then people say, well, you know, the last 50 decades, something like that. Mm. But some other people say, no, you know, the time of colonization of this part of the world, sort of the new world, by Europeans, that brought such a dramatic change that would be really, in terms of land use change, that would be the sort of the crucial moment. So it is difficult to say, but in the large scheme of things, given the age of the Earth and the age that of the sort of in the time span that we're talking about, which is in essence 3.5 billion years of of life on this planet, mm-hmm. you know, in this case, I think we're really very close to around the moment of the Industrial Revolution, I would say.
So one of the things that I would like to talk to you about today is your own research here at Stanford University, too, and how that kind of intersects this concept of the Anthropocene and how things are changing due to anthropogenic effects. Can you talk to me a little bit about your research group here at Stanford?
Yes. And if I may, Brian, I'd like to preface that by doing a little bit of an additional element to the idea of the Anthropocene.
Sure.
And I think that this might be important to convey to our listeners because of the following. You know, given the fact that climate change is such a visible problem and it's such a publicized problem, I think that a lot of the general public and certainly a great proportion of the scientists actually think of a sort of a good indicator or a good or a very typical element that describes the Anthropocene is climate change. Mm-hmm. But I would like to really emphasize that climate change is just one of the several global environmental changes. And you know, in that paper of Paul Crutzen, the idea was really to talk about global environmental changes, not necessarily, not only about climate change. And the reason why I wanted to emphasize that is because climate change is certainly a very important problem, but it's a problem that probably is going to be interacting with other drivers of global change. Mm-hmm. From the point of view of biological diversity, I think there is a very, very crucial component of the global environmental change and that characterizes the Anthropocene, and that is biological extinction.
Absolutely. There have been several, I think, geologic eras that were defined by mass extinctions.
Exactly.
And there is this, you know, this kind of concept that we're in the middle of one right now, the
absolutely.
Sixth extinction. Absolutely.
This might be, some people say, the sixth major pulse of extinction. As some people will remember, you know, within the last 600 years of life of the planet, which is something that's called the Phanerozoic, another period that has a name. Mm-hmm. Within that, there's a number of other periods as well. And there has been a number of significant pulses of extinction, five of them, the most famous of which probably is the one that occurred in the sort of in the transition between the Cretaceous and the Tertiary, the KT, the famous KT, because of the extinction of the dinosaurs,
right.
Which is obviously very sexy and very attractive and so on. But it's not the only one. And in fact, the extinction of the Permian was really, really dramatic, with a very high proportion of the species and genera that we know of went extinct, really much more dramatic than the famous KT of the dinosaurs. But at any rate, people say that this might be sort of the moment of the sixth extinction, given the rate of change in biological diversity. And so there is another thing that might be a little bit controversial, actually. It'd be nice to see what the reaction of our listeners might be. But this has to do with my thinking that perhaps the most critical global environmental change is not necessarily climate change, because of the following. I think that given time and political will and political savviness and things like that, we might be able to fix the climate change situation, given the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Those things could be potentially fixed, but biological extinction is not a reversible thing. So climate change is really very sexy, very important, sexy in the sense that people pay attention to it, but I think that biological extinction is really the most dramatic global environmental change, and I think we should be paying a lot of attention to that driver of change. The reason why I mention all of this is because of your question. Where am I in sort of in this issue of the Anthropocene? I am really in the problem of biological extinction, and you know. You can correct me, but or you can sort of redirect our conversation. But I'd love to take a second to talk about biological extinction, because as people will imagine, it's really very difficult to decide when a species, for example, goes extinct.
Right?
Is a species does a species qualified to be extinct when the last individual disappears? Or is it when the last pair of individuals, male and female, if that's a dioecious species, a species that has both entities, or is it when a population has what geneticists might call the minimum viable population size? I mean, people have come up with a lot of very interesting ideas or notions or names. For example, there is the concept of the living dead. You know, species, organisms that you see, for example, in a tropical rainforest that you're very familiar with,
yes.
like in Southeast Mexico or in Amazonia, mm-hmm. you find that some areas have been so heavily deforested, but you will find some trees sort of in riparian corridors, in some areas, isolated areas here and there. People would say that the species is there because those trees are still present, but from the genetic point of view, from the point of view of having a minimum viable population size, they are dead.
They're effectively extinct, even though they are living and extinct.
You know, they're breeding, they're photosynthesizing, and so on and so forth. Some insects that might be flying, and so on. They might be the living dead. So some people have come up with that idea. Some people suggest that, you know, there's a lot of that going on. So, you know, when a species is extinct is kind of a tricky thing.
So I think we're talking a lot about, like, species changes in areas and plant and animal interactions. So,
yes.
If there is a change in one species in an area mm-hmm. due to anthropogenic activity, you know, that can cascade its way through an ecosystem.
Yes.
So, and in particular, I know you look at animal-facilitated seed dispersal for plants.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So can you tell me a little bit about your research in that kind of topic? And
right.
Okay.
Absolutely, Brian. And I think that brings about another interesting concept and at least a name that might be interesting for people to think about and reflect on what it might imply. We use the term coextinction,
right.
Talking about coextinction.
Mm-hmm.
And that connects with your question.
Mm-hmm.
It could be associated to the case in which a particular animal operates as a sort of the farmer of a plant, in the sense that the animal will eat the fruit of a plant and in so doing will disperse the seeds of the plant to another area where the seeds will germinate very well and so on. That, by the way, brings about another interesting aspect of the ecology and evolution of the species interactions. For example, many trees in temperate areas, in tropical areas, in deserts and so on and so forth, have fruits that are very attractive. And we might think that those are wonderful things that, that the trees are producing for us, Homo sapiens, right?
Exactly.
But yeah. In fact, that is not the case. Those wonderful fruits, very tasty, very nutritious in some cases, are produced for a very selfish reason by the tree, which right. is to attract an animal that will move the genes, in this case expressed in the seed, that will go to another area where the tree is going to be dispersed. Anyway, so let's imagine for a second that you have a situation of a tree that is very important for a number of species or a particular species, even if it's just one species of an animal, let's say a bat or an animal that would be a frugivore meaning an animal that loves and enjoys and makes its living of eating fruit, right? If that particular species is so crucial for that a bat or toucans or birds or other mammals, if that species goes extinct locally or globally, that might probably bring about the extinction of a bunch of animals that depended on that tree, that depended on the fruits of that tree. And so that will be, you know, sort of a situation of co-extinction, because it's not only one element. Given the ecological and evolutionary interactions of plants and animals, for example, via dispersal, that would be a case of co-extinction. And that's one of the things that we're really concerned about in our lab. And I'd like to mention it because after all, we really can think about species being the product of organic evolution. Mm-hmm. And if we really want to go back and have a large perspective on evolution, we can say that evolution and the biodiversity that we have nowadays, product of evolution, is really the result of about 3.5 years of organic processes.
3.5 billion years, yeah.
3.5 billion years, yeah. That's a lot of time, right? Mm-hmm. And then, especially when one thinks of the Anthropocene, connecting things again, you know, one species that came out in that incredibly long period in the last second of the geological time. So, you know, in terms of the length of that time, is one species that's 1% of 1% of the time. It's a really, really tiny representation in the big scheme of things. For that species to be the driver of extinction of something that took 3.5 years of evolution, that might actually be an ethical and even a moral issue to consider. So, beyond the fact that species might play different ecological roles and might have different services from the human perspective, it is quite possible. I mean, I think we should not close our eyes to the possibility that people might think that those are the products of organic evolution. And, you know, it's such a complex and natural and important process that led to our presence, in fact, in the planet, all of those species should be equally important. So that's another interesting
kind of an argument against that idea of relative importance. I mean, that kind of implies some things are worth kind of keeping around and some things
aren't. And sometimes
are
not. But then, you know, you will have people who would say, okay, but, you know, these are products of evolution.
Right. I have a hard time making a case that we should keep around measles or mumps, you know, those viruses. They're arguably living beings, but they're human pathogens. But again, like you said, they exist and are products of this wonderful billennia-long process.
Yeah. Multillennia, right?
Multi-millennia.
Yes, and absolutely. I mean, and that. But then you know, there's another thing that might be interesting to consider and perhaps even discuss, which is the fact that, it is quite possible that people might say, you know, I'm listening to these guys talking about biological diversity, but and then functions of the ecosystem and processes. What about if I have a eucalypt plantation, right? If I'm interested in the process of, for example, photosynthesis, mm-hmm. what about if I just have a eucalypt plantation or a pine tree plantation? And, you know, from the point of view of capturing carbon and releasing oxygen, that might be sort of the same as perhaps a diverse community. But what about if a pathogen comes by? If a pathogen comes to a plantation in which all the trees are the same species, and furthermore, all the trees are genetically very, very similar, the other component of biodiversity that we were trying to talk about, that pathogen actually will wipe out that plantation basically very easily. Consider the sort of the contrasting situation, a plantation that has many different species, and even within each one of the species, a lot of genetic variation, it's going to be much harder for the pathogen to actually wipe out and invade that population. the reason why we're talking about this is because of the function of species in an ecosystem. It could well be that the critical issue of having diversity is like an insurance mechanism against things that you cannot see or predict right now happening, like a pathogen.
I think that a lot of our listeners are going to be fairly familiar with the idea of deforestation.
Yes.
And its consequences. It's received a lot of press. You know, we kind of...
A lot of attention.
A lot of attention.
Yeah.
In 1991, you had a book chapter that you co-authored about the idea, this other idea called defaunation.
Yes.
And can you maybe talk about defaunation in particular, focusing on Las Tuxtlas?
Right, right. So, you know, that paper, 1991, the idea of using the word defaunation was to try and convey the notion that just as we talk about deforestation, that a term that everybody will understand and will have an image in their minds as to what deforestation might be, we are not really paying attention to the fact that the animals are also being lost from ecosystems, quite dramatically, actually, except that, you know, in the case of the animals, it is really very difficult to document that. Let's talk about deforestation for another second. Nowadays, with this amazing technology of the remote sensing tools, satellite images and so on, you can see an image of, say, Las Tuxtlas by using aerial photographs from the 1960s, then the satellite images of the 1970s, the 80s, the 90s, and 2000s, and you can dramatically see the changes in the forest, right? And you can actually measure the magnitude of change from one moment to another divided by the number of years,
time.
By time, and you will calculate a very precise number, the rate of deforestation. So, you know, we're perfectly aware of that situation and we pay attention to that. And of course, it's really very worrisome and there's a lot of publicity, just as you said. But go to Las Tuxtlas and, you know, you walk in this amazing forest. It looks so lush and green, exuberant, and you don't see the animals. And you don't worry because you say, well, the animals are really very difficult to see. Many of them are going to be nocturnal species.
They're secretive.
They're very secretive. You know, yeah. So that for that very situation is kind of an invisible threat. We don't really see what's happening to the animals unless you begin to really carefully start monitoring animals. And then you begin to see the situation.
So what are the kinds of things that you've seen in regards to defaunation, specifically at Las Tuxtlas?
At Las Tuxtlas, yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I noticed when I was actually the director of the station, I began to notice that some particular species were so incredibly abundant, particularly at the understory level. The understory level means sort of the lower parts of the stratification of a forest, going from the canopy, although the upper canopy, sort of the mid canopy, and then to the lower canopy, and then basically the sort of the ground level, the understory.
You can think about it like if we were walking around in the rainforest, that would be where we would be standing in the
understory. Exactly, where we would be walking, right? Mm-hmm. And you would be seeing a lot of plants there and some small trees, sort of your height and so on. That's kind of the understory. Anyway, so, you know, when I was living there and I began to see that some of the species are really, really very abundant in the understory. And so people think, oh, you know, this is a fantastic forest. This forest is so green and lush and exuberant. But in fact, you know, I began to think, what about if this incredible abundance, hyperabundance, exuberance of some species, particularly some species here, is a reflection of something anomalous in this forest? And I found that on average, about 10% of the leaf area, of the amount of foliage on the plants, is eaten by insects. And of course, it's difficult to say, well, you know, insects are not having such a tremendous impact because they're only taking about 10%. At the same time, I began to see that if you go out at night, it's really very difficult to see, you know, tapirs, peccaries, and deer. And so I said, is there a connection between those two things, you know, the absence of the animals and the fact that some species, particularly some species that tend to have very large seeds, or some species that when they're baby plants have spines, like a famous plant that you know.
The Astrocarium
Mexicanum palm, which is full of spines. And then you think, well, why would this tree or this palm will have so many spines? Perhaps it is to deal with animals. But what about if the animals are not present? And then that's one of the reasons why these palm is so incredibly abundant in the understory. So I began to connect sort of those kind of isolated facts, and then I came up with the idea of defaunation. Maybe those changes that we see in the plant community, the understory, are the result of the absence of the animals. Mm. The crucial thing, and that's one thing that I think made the paper visible and create some waves, is that, you know, if you think about the understory, really this is the baby plants of the forest of the future,
right?
Because that's the regeneration of the forest. So if you're changing the structure, diversity, and so on of the understory, in the long term, you might be changing the actual structure and diversity of the forest as a whole.
This feeds really nicely into what we're talking about, this idea of the Anthropocene, of this man-made anthropogenic change of what, you know, what communities are going to look like in the future.
Exactly. So, you know, that would be a legacy of the Anthropocene, mm-hmm. a forest that is, that right now is changed in the baby community of the plants over the long term. So what we're finding in the deformation poles, deformation process that we see nowadays in the Anthropocene, is that the medium and large sized animals are the ones that are sort of suffering the most the impact of deformation. If we were in the tropical rainforest, we talk about anything that goes from the size of a peccary to the tapir and jaguars, for example.
And why do you think that is? What's targeting the medium to large size
animals? Yeah, a number of reasons. Yeah, a number of reasons. For example, large-sized species, they usually have a few babies per litter. Mm-hmm. So smaller birth rates, you know, not as many as a rat, for example.
Right.
So smaller population growth rates, so that's one. The generation time is much longer, so it takes a longer time for one generation to produce the next generation. So think of an elephant and compare that with a squirrel.
A mouse.
Or a mouse, yeah. And, you know, those species tend to need or depend on a much larger home range. That's a concept that refers to this idea of how much area you need to maintain a viable population, right? Mm. So the larger the species, the larger the animals, the larger the home range that they will need. And of course, given deforestation and fragmentation, that is impacting the big guys that need larger areas, not so much the little guys. And here's the connection. Here's the trick. So we see deformation being impacting the medium and large animals, but the little guys, rodents, mice, rats, chipmunks, those kinds of things, we are finding, this is the amazing thing, Brian, we find that these guys are not only not being impacted, but in fact, they are increasing in the relative abundances. So, you know, one possible legacy of the Anthropocene, we're still working on documenting that, but it seems to me that one legacy of the Anthropocene in relation to deformation is a dramatic change in the structure of the animal communities. With the medium and large guys absent or in very low numbers, and the little guys increasing in their abundances quite dramatically. I am going to use now a term that I'm trying to put in my forthcoming papers, which is rodentation.
Rodentation.
Or rodentization. I don't know. I'm still debating.
Rodentization. Rodentation.
Rodentation sounds good. Okay. You know, it's another aspect of the deformation story, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
The rise
not
of
homogeneous,
the small mammal.
Exactly. But then, you know, it's interesting to reflect on that for a minute. That means changes in the seed predation patterns.
Absolutely.
In a tropical forest, or very close to our hearts, and in fact, very close to our survival, rodents tend to be very good at spreading some diseases. And again, not all species of rodents. You know,
absolutely.
Our planet is rich in diversity, so not all rodents are the same, are equal. So, but some species we do know that are very good in sort of operating as vectors of disease. Mm-hmm. So although we've been talking about Los Tuxtlas, where I have done most of my research and my students have done research with me there looking at the consequences of deformation, right now with some students at Stanford University, we're looking at the consequence of deformation on human health. And this is in the African savannas, mostly in Kenya. And it is pretty much the same. If I can really very quickly describe it really
sure.
1 second. So let's imagine a savanna in which, because of hunting, illegal trading, or habitat destruction, we are eliminating the populations of elephants, giraffes, zebras, and so on. So again, the meso and megafauna, the medium-sized and the large-sized animals. By using some experimental manipulations, in this case, electrified fences to simulate defaunation, and comparing those electrified areas protected by electrified fences simulating defaunation with areas in which all animals are present, the control sites, and from an experimental point of view, we have found in the lab here at Stanford that obviously grasses and shrubs increase dramatically in the absence of the big animals. But that's not the end of the story. Then rodents come up, as they say in the U.S., big time, you know, roughly 2.5 times more abundance of rodents in the defaunated sites. So here you have a manifestation of the Anthropocene rodentation. So it happens then that we are collecting the fleas and the ectoparasites that these rodents are carrying. So imagine, you know, my students and myself combing rats and so on with this beautiful comb, and somebody with a container underneath with alcohol collecting all of these fleas. Right. And then we also sort of tickle and push the tummy of these animals to get the feces and collect and look for the endoparasites. So we're trapping hundreds, if not thousands, or actually thousands of rodents now, given this rodentization process that we're seeing, the increase in rodents. But the samples are being sent to a number of labs in the U.S., including the CDC, the Center for Disease Control,
right,
for them to use molecular tools and identify the pathogens. This is still very, very preliminary, Brian, but we're finding wonderful things from the ecological point of view, the connection between defaunation, land use change, and rodentization, but horrible from the point of view of human health.
Exactly, yeah.
In some of the samples, not very high abundances, at least not now, because we have not screened all the samples, just a very small proportion, but that includes things such as plague, for example, you know, Black Death, Bartonellas, an incredible number of rodent-borne diseases. So rodentation is sort of beyond just a wonderful academic exercise, if people can call that a wonderful academic exercise, sort of discovery of ecological disruption of ecological processes, cascading effects, as you said at the beginning, but also phenomena that can have a tremendous impact on human populations. And, you know, if we think about that for a minute, so defaunation, rodentation, where is that happening? It's happening in areas where human populations are high also. And if you have, you know, higher rates of transmission of disease because of the rodentation, if the human population is also in high densities, then the potential problem is going to be sort of exacerbated, multiplied because of these sort of vicious circle of all of these components, led by an apparently simple and innocent thing, which is defaunation.
Dr. Diuzzo, I really want to thank you very much for your time today and coming and talking to us a little bit about your work and the Anthropocene in general, and wish you luck in your continued endeavors here at Stanford.
Thank you so very much, Brian. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project, and you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?